of Minnesota. I'm very pleased that you're with us today. We're also shared in sponsorship of this lecture with Justice for All, a student organization on campus, as well as another organization called the University of Minnesota Christian Medical Dental Association. Thanks for your attendance today. As many of you know, the issue of abortion in the USA, which will be commemorated this Thursday, the 31st anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, the issue of abortion in the USA is an issue that has polarized this nation, and in many respects, people view the issue of abortion and the reality of abortion in American life as an indication of, in part, the cultural war that we're facing today. Many people describe abortion and the practice of abortion and its widespread use as a modern Holocaust. But many people do not realize that behind this political framing of the whole issue of abortion is a larger cultural phenomenon that's taking place in our society and abroad. And our speaker today addresses the issues related to abortion from a cultural framework. He is a person who wants to get behind the politics, behind the rhetoric. He invites us to understand what is going on with abortion, invites us to consider issues of justice and community in relationship to the debate about the unborn. And so I want you to welcome with me today a professor, former professor of pediatrics at the University of Ottawa in Canada, and now president of Augustine College, Dr. John Patrick. Will you welcome him with me?
It's a great pleasure for me to be in Minnesota, not least because the temperature is 20 degrees warmer than it was at home. But this issue, of course, is one that for years I stayed away from, because for 20 years I was pro-choice. I called myself a Christian and didn't see any incoherence between those two positions. Of course, the reasons were very straightforward. When I began my medical career in the 60s, I was doing infectious diseases at that point, and regularly seeing women with a rash who would come and say, "Is this rubella?" And I would say, "Well, it looks like it, and we can be sure. Let's take some blood today, some more in a week, and I'll see you a couple of days later." They would have paired titers, and if the titer's rising, then yes, you have rubella. And then I would have the not very pleasant duty of looking at the possible outcomes. Obviously, if it was past 3 months, there was a zero risk. But in those first 9 months, there was anything up to a 90% probability of a child with major neurological and cardiac problems. And I had already divorced what I thought I believed from the practice of medicine. And so I was into the problem-solving mode. And so it seemed to me that this disaster was best mitigated by starting again. And we actually arranged therapeutic abortions when they were in fact strictly illegal. Now, that's where I started from, and it took me a long while to process what I'm going to share with you this morning, or this afternoon, actually. Let me begin with an obvious question. Is there any possibility of agreement in your medical school class, or indeed in society, about abortion? And of course, the answer is no, isn't it? In fact, in any medical school class, if I wished, I could have you shouting at one another in about 90 milliseconds plus. But what I actually want to achieve, if possible, is not less civility, but more civility. And I think that can be achieved by deepening the way we think about this problem. Let me ask you another question now. How many of you are medical students, first of all? Not enough for my purposes. If I was to say to you that within 6 weeks of starting medical school, you had decided that there were some people in your class to whom you would never trust the care of a dog of yours, what would you say? That's right. There's always that little laughter, that little nod, that rueful smile. And if I took a consensus vote, even in such an upright place as Minneapolis, would there be agreement in your class as to who those people were? And I know the answer is yes. So in other words, within 6 weeks of starting medical school, you know that something like up to 20% of the class ought not to be there. It would be better for patients and better for medicine if they weren't. And you know who they are. Now, we the faculty don't find out till several years after graduation when they lose their licenses for horrendous behavior. It never comes as a shock to their peer group. They knew it was coming. What comes as a shock to them is that some of them managed to get away with it for so long. So, there's already a problem in the class about the nature of behavior. What is acceptable, what isn't. But let's leave that 10 or 20% on one side. Those that remain are still divided over the issue of abortion. But we still have a lot in common. You see, our moral consensus actually began fracturing a long while ago. You can actually trace the history back, amazingly, to four men who were all Christian theists. Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton. You see, what they provided us with was a mechanical model of the universe, so to speak, a mechanical metaphor. And they also provided us, and the people who followed them, with the view that inductive reasoning could work. You did not need to believe in God to use it once it had been shown to work. Although you needed to believe in God, I think, in order to use it in the first place. But that's another lecture. But within 100 years or so of Newton, Laplace, in conversation with Napoleon, when asked where God fitted into his science, Laplace, a practicing Catholic, said, "Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis." And so four men who were Christian theists gave us a science which is tacitly atheistic. Now, what I mean by tacitly is that nobody says it's atheistic. You simply behave as though God is of no significance. And that is perfectly true that you can manage science that way. But it's historically very rude, at the least, not to acknowledge the history that made it possible. Now, the end of the 19th century, the standard view, largely coming from the States and from Cornell, was that there was a war between science and faith. Now, most historians of science have changed their view. Most of them would now say, no, there was no war between science and faith. Faith was actually necessary for science to get going. The Catholic Church was not the greatest patron of science, but it was the only patron to begin with. And it didn't begin in the 16th century. It began way back in the 13th, or even before that. It's a long, slow process. But that separation of the university, because it was called a university in the past because the concept in the 12th century was that all knowledge was unitary. It was all God's knowledge, ultimately. That's why it was called the university. Now, of course, you're not at the University of Minnesota. You're at the Multiversity of Minnesota. Professors in different faculties use the same words with different meanings. I mean, we in the science faculty naively think that we're actually discovering something true about the world. Whereas many people in the arts faculty would argue that truth is not a category that's open to us and is really a meaningless discussion. That makes life very difficult. It's interesting, though, however, that those colleagues of mine who hold that position, should they get sick, are not prepared to go to a surgeon who says, "Oh, well, today I feel like operating left-handed." They're incoherent, in other words. So there's a long history behind what we're talking about today. And the Second World War certainly exacerbated it. And that's when it took off. As a child of the 50s and 60s, I know a little about that. But nevertheless, you still mainly, I hope, let me just ask you, the medical students in the class, in the lecture room, apart from the 20% that you don't trust, do you expect the rest of the class to practice ethical medicine by and large? Good, I'm glad to see enough nods for me to feel comfortable as you come online, so to speak. Yet, we profoundly disagree about one aspect of life. You see, when I began in medicine, one circle of a Venn diagram would enclose what we understood as the ethical practice of medicine. We didn't necessarily do it, but we didn't argue about what it was. So there were no lectures on ethics. And by the way, lectures on ethics only make you an ethicist. They don't make you ethical. But that also is another hour's lecture. When I said that to our dean when we started ethics lectures in Ottawa, he said, what on earth do you mean? And I said, well, I'm probably the only member of your faculty that has lunch regularly with some of the philosophers. And the guy you have hired to teach ethics is actually, you know, technically quite good. But he's also honest. He says, I only teach ethics, I don't practice them. And he was perfectly serious. He left the university in rather a hurry a year or two ago because at long last one of his graduate students complained about his habits. Ethics lectures may make you more sophisticated, but they will not make you ethical. But we did have a consensus. It was a Judeo-Christian consensus, basically. It could be argued all the way through from the Torah to the present. But with the introduction of abortion, that Venn diagram became two circles, right? It pulled apart into two circles, and the bit that was no longer held in common was what we believe about the moral status of the human being before they're born. Now, during your lifetime, that's the students, that Venn diagram is going to become a multi-lobed phenomenon. It is already, it's just that abortion is the major one. But you're going to have to deal with such issues as eugenics, as well as lifestyles, numerous things that we're not going to agree on. In other words, the foundation, the ethical foundation of medicine is being eroded. At the end of the lecture, if I've got time, I will speculate on what I think might happen. But undoubtedly, medicine is going to be a more uncomfortable profession to practice unless we think our way through this and start wondering how we're going to deal with it. You see, because essentially, medicine is a moral activity, not a scientific or technical one. You see, what you do when you see a patient is a moral choice rather than a technical one. Is there any treatment that you might prescribe that is mandatory for all patients? And the answer is no, isn't it? They have to choose. So what you're actually doing is helping them to decide what they ought to do. Now, you cannot get from a factual statement to a moral statement without cheating. Imagine that Bob here has cancer. Imagine that I have the cure for his cancer in my pocket. Ought I to give it to him? Now, come on, he has some friends. Not many, though. Hopefully you would say yes, but you know that I'm out to trap you and you don't wish to be trapped. It's all right. Intellectual honesty is good for you. But what if I am a really well thought out Darwinian? And what if Bob is a wealthy man and when he dies I inherit his estate? What do I do now? Surely there can be no Darwinian argument against putting his genes out of the reproductive cycle and increasing the wealth of mine, and then marketing my cure later. Darwin himself understood that problem. You'll find it in one of his letters. So medicine is a moral activity, but you cannot get from the physical statements, I have the cure, he has the cancer, to the moral injunction, give it to him, unless you import into the argument the statement to save life is good. But clearly, in the Western world, we now say, to save life is good, except the life of. And the caveats are increasing, aren't they? It used to be just the first 12 weeks. It got all the way up to birth. Peter Singer is arguing you ought to have 3 months to decide whether you want to keep the baby. When you become elderly and no longer have a mind that works, and if you have the wrong gene set, it's getting complex. Now, so the real problem actually is not abortion. That's probably the major thing for you to take away with you. Abortion is a symptom. And the real question is, what would it be necessary to believe to make choice a central item of your ethics, and what would it be necessary to make the sanctity of life the central portion of your ethics, and which system will serve society best? It's a question of rationality. Now, can we unpack it at all? I think we can. You see, I was easily bought into the choice mode because I lived in the 60s. If ever choice was first, that's when it was. And of course, nowadays, the basic ethics of most American children is summarized not even in a word, but in a symbol, a tick, right? Just do it. And they are. So I intuitively accepted that point of view. I couldn't actually derive it from the principles I said I believed. So my problem was, in retrospect, I didn't even think about it at the time, that I had an intuitive, felt response to the motivation of choice. But I said I had principles which were actually in contradiction of it. And of course, I can ask you a question that illustrates this for you. Raise your hand if you could rationally justify the taking of an innocent human life. You can't, you see. You may think you can, but most people, there's a couple who think they can. And there are situations with certain beliefs where that is true, and I want to unpack that for you. But most of you don't think that. And yet, about half of you in your class would be pro-choice. You see, your moral knowledge and your moral feelings are different. Moral feelings are quite capable of being changed, but moral knowledge is not. Ultimately, you have to spend a great deal of energy to deny moral knowledge. All men everywhere know that the taking of innocent life is wrong. What we have to do, therefore, is redefine innocence or redefine life. Now, the desire for abortion was practical. How did it come about? What is necessary for someone to do abortion and be ethical? Well, it's not difficult. In Canada, it's actually particularly easy to defend this position, because the man who has been the leader of the abortion movement in Canada is a man called Dr. Henry Morgenthaler. Now, he lost all his family except one brother in Auschwitz. Does it surprise you that he does not believe in a God of love? I hope not. I wonder if I would, if I'd had that experience. That's what happened to him. His brother survived, actually. His brother kept him alive. Amazingly, his brother is still an Orthodox Jew and is appalled at what Henry does. But Henry became an existentialist. After the experience of Auschwitz, he said, life has no meaning. But he inhabited the Jewish tradition of compassion for those who are suffering. It's a long tradition, and it's a very honorable one. That's why they regularly, in almost every city, provide some of the best physicians in the city. If you arrive blind in a city and you're sick and you don't know who to go to, statistically a Jewish physician would be a pretty good deal most of the time. And Henry belonged in that tradition. So when he sees a woman with a pregnancy that she does not want and that she's not ready for, he sees a woman who is suffering. I hope you all do, don't you? And she's facing three options. She can have an abortion, she can give the child up for adoption, or she can keep it. If she has the abortion, we ought to tell her, and you medical students can check that I'm not making this up in the next few years, that she will never forget the date. When you're taking your obstetric and previous medical history data in your history taking, people will often have difficulty knowing which year a major operation occurred, and certainly have some difficulties with spontaneous miscarriages, but they rarely have any difficulty with giving you the date of an abortion. And frequently you'll find yourself dealing with tears. That ought to be said for no other reason than we ought to be honest about the data. So, yes, it can be done, but there are consequences. Giving the child up for adoption, does that have consequences? Oh, yes. You're going to spend a lot of your life wondering what it's doing and feeling somewhat disloyal. And what about keeping the baby? Well, it's going to economically marginalize you and probably put your career in jeopardy. It's not good news, whichever way you look. For Henry, the cleanest solution is the abortion, because he thinks that life is ultimately absurd. His ethics are utilitarian ethics of increasing the net happiness in the world. So what he sees when a woman comes to him wanting an abortion is two human lives. He's not a liar. It's alive, otherwise you wouldn't be doing the abortion. And it has a human, not a cat or a dog's, genome. And if you left it alone, if you left it to the number of years you've had, it would be something like you in that number of years. So it's human and it's living. But it is unself-conscious. When you are unself-conscious, are you either happy or unhappy? You're neither, are you? That's why you go to sleep when you're depressed. You sleep more to get away from the unhappiness, because you have to be conscious to have it. It applies both ways around. So when he has snuffed out the absurd, unself-conscious human life, he says the net happiness in the world has increased. And that is true. But if, and only if, life is absurd. You only have to put Mother Teresa by the bed in imagination to see the other position. What she sees is two eternally significant lives, one of whom is about to put her soul in jeopardy. What is the rational thing to do now? The exact opposite. It's not that one group is rational and the other irrational, one intellectual and intelligent and the other stupid and bigoted. Not at all. There are two competing ideas of what human rationality should be understood to be. And neither is capable of proving its own position to the exclusion of the other. So we do need some civility. We need to respect each other's position, recognizing what's at stake. But don't fix on abortion, go to what matters. How do you understand what it means to be human? So, are we stuck? Must this impasse be accepted and just leave it at that? Which is what many people would like. I think not. Because we can look at the rational outcomes. You're being taught medicine on an outcomes-based process, aren't you? That's the trendy thing at the moment. Evidence-based medicine, outcomes-based medicine. It's not unreasonable. It's a bit overstated. You only have to ask whose evidence which medicine to see that there are some discussions that haven't taken place that need to take place. But leave that on one side for the moment. Can we look at it any further? Well, we can. And if you look at the history, and having lived through it all, my own history fits this. You see, because we deep down cannot know, not know rather, we cannot. It's impossible to avoid recognizing that taking an innocent life is wrong. When abortion was introduced, initially the way around it was to say, well, it was really just a bunch of cells. It was a bit of an intellectual cop-out, but it worked for a while. Except that the women immediately realized after the experience that if it was just a bunch of cells, experientially it felt very different from having a tooth out. You didn't get over it in the same way. And of course, one of the founders of the abortion movement in North America, Bernard Nathanson, who was an unbelieving Jew at the time, actually born in Ottawa, where I come from, went to McGill. His father was a senior Jew in Ottawa. At one point he aborted his own child, and as he says, without any guilt at all at that time, because neither my girlfriend nor I wanted it. To cut a long story short, he was intellectually honest, and he began to realize that this was much more than he had thought it was as the science of fetology developed. I mean, he's now in his 70s. And that's what happened. Now, thoughtful feminists realized they wanted to help people who were having an abortion and feeling bad. And what they did was pull apart two words that were tautological before. When I began in medicine, human being and human person were essentially the same concept. But it was a biological definition. It was objective. A living creature with a human genome which is organized to the extent that it can become a fully functioning, a fully recognizable human being. What does it mean to be a fully functional human being? Ask your spouse. They'll certainly be doubtful about you. But there's no way around that particular definition. So a new one had to be introduced, and many were tried. The one that's probably most dominant is you become a person when you are capable of relationship. But all the new definitions that were introduced that you can follow through the medical ethical literature tend to be psychological, sociological and political, not objectively biological. And that helped a little bit. But you see, we are logical, but slowly. We don't teach you logic anymore, so it's easy to confuse you, but Nevertheless, it's partly hardwired into us. So over time, the logic of our choices always goes on to the next step. When abortion was legalized in Britain, it was legalized by case law over a case of incest. And it was clear that it would also cover the kinds of things I was involved with. So not incest, rape. But when Vaughan gave himself up for that case and got it through the courts, the jury wouldn't convict him. He thought a few cases per year would now be done without any fear. He certainly did not, and neither did I, see 52 million abortions worldwide as the outcome within 40 years or so. Nobody saw that. That was a logical progression. Your Supreme Court understood that. They recognized that once contraception was the norm and trusted to be effective, as they said in the Roe v. Wade case, modern society is predicated on the basis of effective contraception. When it fails, there must be a backup. That was one of the major arguments. And that's why abortion was legalized. But once this new way of thinking had come along, of course, this is no longer an intrinsic right to exist, an objective one, but a subjective one. And in a deep sense, I think our society has been changed by the fact that every child, for instance, born before 1973 and after 1973 is in fact very different. Children born before 1973 had a right to exist. Children born after 1973 were chosen to exist. That has an impact. It's not an accident that with the growth of abortion there's also been a parallel growth of a huge literature on how to improve your self-image. Not at all unrelated. Now, this issue then had taken an intrinsic right to exist and made it extrinsic in two ways. One, you had to be chosen by your mother, and two, the court gave your mother the right to do it. So it's also changed human rights. The inalienable rights to life have been replaced by an alienable right that the justices can change at will. So it's a fundamental change in the culture at that level. What the judges didn't realize is how much more was involved. See, if you are chosen, you're chosen for a purpose. And if the definition of when you reach the stage of being able to have human rights is subjective, you have to earn it. And you might lose it. And that's what's happening, of course. That's why at the other end of life, Peter Singer says, people with Alzheimer's ought to be put down like dogs because they're no longer people. Ironically, when his own mother got Alzheimer's, he looked after her until she died. But he said, I'm human, I'm still caught up in all sorts of irrationalities. He thinks really he ought to have been stronger than he was. And it's logical. One of the last groups of children I was deeply involved with were children with cystic fibrosis. Now, when I began in medicine, cystic fibrosis was one disease. Last time I looked, it was about 35. But the most important thing about getting the CF gene, it hasn't done anything therapeutically dramatically good. But it immediately, as with all the genomic data, gives us the capacity for antenatal diagnosis. So, now, when a mother comes with a baby who has CF, she'll be sent to the clinic so that the next baby, the next pregnancy, can be looked at in advance. Now, what that leads to is eugenic abortion. Now, all these kids in the clinics know one another. And one not-so-bright, naive little kid will say at a clinic, my mom went to hospital, but it wasn't for me. I wonder what she went for. She wouldn't tell me. And one of the smarter kids says, oh, she went for abortion. She was going to have another baby like you. She got rid of it. Do you think that does to the child's self-image? And we're all going to be facing that kind of thing in the near future. Which things are not going to be acceptable for American society? And we're going to face the tyranny of the measurable, aren't we? I can imagine, I don't think this Brave New World stuff, that it won't be too long before some health insurance company says, we will give you cheap insurance for your baby when it's born. But you do have to have a battery of tests beforehand. And if we tell you, which is unlikely, that this baby is not a good one, you must accept the limit of our liability as the cost of an abortion. Now, imagine you're on the panel looking at the genomic data. And on the same day, you have Mike Tyson and, shall we say, Helen Keller. Let's assume that Helen Keller was blind and deaf because of a genetic disorder, not because of an infection, which it could have been. Which one's going to get through? Mike Tyson's going to walk it, isn't he? And Helen Keller will be down the sink. Would America be a better place because of that? We cannot measure the things about ourselves that matter most. And the direction we're going is frightening. I did a lot of work with severely damaged CP children, quadriplegic children, who will never walk, talk, or feed themselves. The reason I was interested in them was that I have a long interest in severely malnourished children, and children with quadriplegia, high quadriplegia, actually have a very inefficient swallowing mechanism, about 10% efficiency. Since you need to eat for about an hour a day to provide your nutrient intake, if you had 10% efficiency, you'd have to eat for 10 hours. Nobody can do that. So they become malnourished. Once I realized this and went looking, this by putting pegs into them, basically, so that their basic nutrients could bypass the problem with swallowing and eating could become just for pleasure. Now, it usually takes a mother who has one of these babies 2 years to come to terms with the fact that she can't even feed this baby adequately. I had one mother one day who had come to terms with this very swiftly, within 6 months. So I was putting the permanent tube in outpatients. And I said to her, look, he's going to cry. It only hurts for a moment, but there's no way of avoiding it. Do you want to go out to the clinic while I do it? And she said, no, you can trust me, I won't interfere. I'll hold his hand. So I stretched the plastic out and took the soft tube out and popped the new one in. And he cried and she comforted him. And I said to her, you're doing extraordinarily well. You're way ahead of the curve. Do you mind explaining to me why? And she looked at me as though I needed remedial training, which I did. And she said, well, I had a family when I was very young. And they've all grown up and gone away. So God has given me a baby who will never grow up. I love him. But that wasn't all. She said, she then went on to explain how this child who will never eat, will never feed himself, never walk, never talk, is civilizing a whole neighborhood. Because she lives in one of the poorer parts of town, where lots of parents have made sometimes an economically necessary choice, but often a wrong choice. They want more money, and they don't appreciate quite what a child is. So these kids come home from school as latchkey kids and let themselves in and watch god-awful television and videos. But once there's a little guy there with a button under his shirt, they use a syringe to feed him. That was cool. They all wanted to have a go. So instead of going home, they all came to visit him. So this little guy, who can't do anything, is the means by which they are learning to be gentle, to take their turn, and you don't need to swear here. He's civilizing a whole neighborhood. If the liberal elite who refuse to think have their way, such means of civilization will no longer exist. Now, not only had the judges embarked on this process, but they had actually cut off the limb on which they themselves sit. Because, you see, abortion is profoundly corrosive to the very idea of justice. Now, the person who understood this was an unbelieving, as far as I can tell, unbelieving Jewish professor of common law at Yale. As far as I know, he's dead now. Arthur Leff. He was a very much loved teacher, a great teacher. But in 1979, he gave a very brilliant lecture at Duke, because he was worried about lawyers, as no doubt many of you are, but he was worried about what was happening to them in terms of the law and in terms of justice. And the lecture was unspeakable justice, unnatural law, unspeakable ethics, unnatural law. Duke Law Review, 1979, if you want to get it. An unusually lucid academic lecture. So good, I can paraphrase the first paragraph. It begins like this. He says, I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete, immanent, and transcendent set of propositions about right and wrong. findable rules that direct us as to how to live our lives righteously. Now, he's an unbelieving Jew. What's he talking about? He's talking about Torah. The law which the Jews believe is given by God but is available to them, transcendent and immanent. Why does he want it? Because when there is a law over us all, then the judge and the judged are under the same authority. But Lev goes on. I also want to believe, and so do you, in no such thing. But rather that we are wholly free to decide for ourselves what we ought to do and what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is simultaneously to be perfectly ruled and perfectly free. That is, at the same time, to discover the right and the good and to create it. And even Americans can't do that. You must choose which side of that equation you're on. You see, the choice was made that the law is a human artifact and your robed masters in the Supreme Court can tell you what to believe, in effect. They've certainly taken away the inalienable right to life, but they've also dismantled justice. Because since these judges no longer believe in God and God's transcendent laws, on what basis do they make their judgments? Well, all that's left to them, of course. Their genes, their environment, their desires. As Lewis put it many years ago, thus, man's conquest of nature turns out to be nature's conquest of man. And we become not creatures made in the image of God, but merely highly developed animals. The rise of the animal rights movement is also related to abortion. And it's not an accident that Peter Singer was one of the foremost leaders of that particular process. As he says, if asked to choose between a tadpole and a human embryo, fertilized human egg, I'd choose the tadpole. He can move. Now he's being somewhat facetious, but also making a deeply significant point. Many of you do consider yourselves to be no more than highly developed animals, and I have to be careful, because that leads me into yet another hour's lecture. But of course, the other thing that disappears in this process is the meaning of suffering. Because suffering becomes something that shouldn't happen. We ought to predict its coming and get rid of the baby before it suffers. But that would mean getting rid of the Helen Kellers of this world, the Joni Ericssons. And I don't know what other physicians in this room think, but week by week, as I did my clinic for the severely disabled, I would come away wondering who the patient was. And I needed that civilization. We are moving too fast beyond our moral power. What the logical progressions can be next, of course, I don't yet know, because I'm not smart enough. But that this particular set of dominoes has gone through that set of changes, starting from that choice, is undeniable. What the next ones are, I do not know. So I think you need to look at those outcomes. And you need to ask yourself, what kind of America do I want my children to grow up in? There is a price to be paid. We're paying it already. You know that. The younger ones of you under the age of 35, I know that you all hate divorce. The older ones will come and complain and say, how dare you say something so insensitive? For all the younger ones in this audience, know that children are hardwired to expect fidelity from their parents. And foolish marriages that are just done on grounds of sensation, what you feel like, often do break up and probably inevitably break up. But better marrying patterns, more seriousness, would be better for children. And the Canadian paediatricians have bitten the bullet and said there is no question the best outcome for children comes when they have two parents of opposite sex who stay together and love one another. Nobody else comes close in terms of outcome. These things are not unrelated. The bigot is the person who will not engage this argument, who will not consider seriously the opposite position to the one they currently hold. You must understand both sides of the argument. You must be able to make both sides of the argument as well as possible. For doctors, the issue is even more important. Margaret Mead, of all people, a long while ago, understood what was at stake here. Let me just read to you what she wrote. It's astonishing to me that it should be her that would have this view. Obviously, I'm hopefully a somewhat orthodox Christian with a small o. I share very little in common with Margaret Mead. In particular, I don't agree with fabricating data. But nevertheless, she was a bright lady and she could write very well. And this is what she wrote about Hippocrates, the father of medicine. For the first time in our tradition, there was a complete separation between killing and curing. Throughout the primitive world, the doctor and the sorcerer tended to be the same person. He with power to kill had power to cure, including especially the undoing of his own killing activities. With the Greeks, the distinction was made clear. One profession, the followers of Asclepius, the Hippocratic physicians, were to be dedicated completely to life under all circumstances, regardless of rank, age, or intellect. By the way, if you take a Hippocratic oath here, you will note that it will remove one line. I will not give an abortive remedy. It will probably take out the line also, I will not counsel suicide. The life of the slave, the life of the emperor, the life of the foreign man, the life of a defective child, all equal. This, says Margaret Mead, is a priceless possession which we cannot afford to tarnish. But society always is attempting to make the physician into a killer, to kill the defective child at birth, to leave the sleeping pills beside the bed of the cancer patient. It is the duty of society to protect the physician from all such requests. Why does she say that? Well, I know why, because I've been in similar situations to her. I spent a lot of time in Africa. Most years when I was going around villages looking at the health of children, I would run into the witch doctor every now and again. Now, the first thing that was apparent was that he was not your local friendly pediatrician. Everybody was frightened of him. I wasn't, of course, but the villagers were. Because he does have power to cure, and he has power to kill. There are plenty of toxins in African plants. Mobutu had his own personal witch doctor. At least 30 people died after having dinner with Mobutu if he didn't like you. That was one of the ways he got rid of you, had dinner with you, and then you went home to die. So if you go to such a doctor, you must always worry whether someone else has paid more for your death than you have paid for your life. And when doctors start taking the lives of patients, it will progress. It is progressing from abortion to euthanasia. And when people die, money changes hands. Certainly that 20% of the class you already don't trust will be tempted. And a good physician has plenty of opportunity to kill patients in ways that nobody would ever detect. My own interest in nutrition, I could actually plan a meal that I could eat with you, and I'd eat the same meal as you, and you would die and I would not. And there'd be nothing to find at post-mortem. I won't tell you what it is. It's my Agatha Christie for one day. But that's also entailed in this process. Trust, you see, is one of the most important therapeutic modalities, and it has been undermined by this process. What are we going to do? I want to leave some time for questions, but just a moment to speculate about what might be worth doing and might be worth thinking about. We claim in the Western world to run our governments democratically. Here's an area where we are not doing so. The medical school and the university are tacitly atheistic. They behave as though God can be left out of any discussion of medicine or the university. But because medicine is a moral activity, as I've demonstrated, that is not true. We also claim, paradoxically enough, to teach patient-centered medicine, right? Now, of Americans, what proportion of them believe in God? And the answer is 90%. And yet your bioethics lecture will be tacitly atheistic, taking a view of the world that represents probably 0.1% of the American population. when your ethics lectures come, ask, why don't we teach ethics in a patient-centered way, in the same way that we teach medicine? Which would actually mean 10 lectures on Judeo-Christian thought, one for all the other world's religions, and you might have a footnote for secular, tacitly atheistic understandings. That isn't what we do. Despite the fact that over 50% of the American population are opposed to abortion, there isn't a single pro-life medical school in the country. How do you justify that on grounds of justice and democracy? Because if medicine is a moral activity, then the patients also have a right to a doctor who shares their moral understanding of the world. Why isn't that happening? It wouldn't do any harm, would it? For you to be able to go to a hospital that shares your understanding of the world, that's what ought to be happening. We're going to be forced, I think, in a little way, in this direction, because of something else that has happened in medicine in my lifetime. I haven't seen it anywhere. It doesn't occur in any textbook of medicine or any textbook of family medicine, as far as I know. But a very profound change has occurred in the nature of etiology. By most physicians with more than 30 years of experience, what proportion of the patients that because of their own behaviour? The answer will usually be, 70% God and nature, 30% behaviour. And what about now? The ratio is completely reversed. And if you're in inner city clinic, they'll laughingly say all of them come because of behaviour. Now, if you are sick and suffering, and your family, whom you claim to love, is suffering also because of your behaviour, what can you not avoid knowing and feeling? The answer, of course, is guilt. Now, the only solutions that human beings have found to guilt over the centuries contains words like atonement, repentance, forgiveness, reconciliation, restitution, justification, grace. Do any of those words occur in the textbook? No. That's why patients getting much better treatment than when I started in medicine actually appreciate medicine much less. Medicine's technical ability has gone through the roof and its public standing has gone through the floor. Why? Because they come to you actually with a burden of guilt which they cannot even name. You treat the cause of that, the medical outcome, the superficiality that spreads from that guilt, you treat it excellently. But you haven't taken their burden away. We're going to need a fundamentally different approach to medicine to deal with this. Because doctors can't even do it. Because it takes time. And your overheads won't allow you to give that time. So prepare for an interesting journey. You live in interesting times. I hope to live long enough when we've closed all the so-called the Christian hospitals and Jewish hospitals of the past. I hope to be around when genuine ones reopen. Certainly, the burden of guilt will never be dealt with by modern medicine, and yet that is the burden that is hurting most Americans. Let me close, as I often do with these lectures, by reading a brief account of what it means to be a doctor. It's my favourite account. Written by a man who, after Hippocrates, is the father of clinical medicine in the Western world. You probably don't know his name, although it is in the textbook because there is one disease named after him. His name is Thomas Sydenham, and he lived in the 17th century. He was the first man to take history seriously, and he wrote beautifully. His descriptions of disease are worth reading to this day. But this is what he wrote when he was president of the Royal College of Physicians. He said, "It becomes every man who purposes to give himself to the care of others seriously to consider the four following things. First, that he must one day give an account to the Supreme Judge of all the lives entrusted to his care. Secondly, that all his skill and knowledge and energy as they have been given by God, so they should be used for his glory and the good of mankind and not for mere gain or ambition. Thirdly, and not more beautifully than truly, let him understand that he has undertaken the care of no mean creature,
For in order that he may estimate the value, the greatness of the human race, the only begotten Son of God became himself a man and thus ennobled it with his divine dignity, and far more than this, died to redeem it. And fourthly, that the doctor being himself a mortal man, he should be diligent and tender in relieving his suffering patients, inasmuch as he himself must one day be a like sufferer. I don't know about you, but if I were dying and that man opened the door of my room and I could say, "Hello, doctor," I would feel deeply privileged. Thank you very much.